Iranian embassy in Syria. Israeli forces kill over 150 Palestinians and injure 60 others in the past 24 hours as the death toll from the regime's genocide in Gaza tops 33,300, defying the growing opposition to Britain's weapons exports to Israel amid the Gaza genocide. London says that it will not halt arms sales to the regime. Hello and welcome, everybody. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Israel made a mistake by attacking Iran's embassy in Damascus, adding that the regime must be and will be punished for its act of aggression. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks in an address after leading the congregational Eid al-Fitr prayers in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei also condemned Western countries for their support for Israel, saying they not only failed to prevent the regime from committing the crimes, rather emboldened it to commit more crimes. During his address, Iran's leader congratulated Iranians and Muslims across the world on Eid al-Fitr. Earlier, Ali Salam, editor-in-chief for Basir Press, joined us from Tehran with his take on the Iran leader's remarks about the recent Israeli attack on the country's diplomatic mission in Syria.
Obviously, this is a declaration in line with international norms that an embassy is property and considered the sovereign soil of whichever country, of any country. This is a standard across the world. So this is essentially an Israeli attack on Iranian soil. And so it is absolutely necessary that this aggressive regime be punished for it. And this is a bloodthirsty regime, and the media in the West may have the script flipped, and they try to convince people that the Islamic Republic of Iran is the one that's crazy, irrational, and bloodthirsty. But actually, Iran is very restrained, moral, and is not out to seek bloodshed. It just knows that to stop the bloodshedders, the ones who are covering the world with blood, that force needs to be met with force. There's no way to go about this in a Gandhi way. Even he himself was not instrumental to the end of British colonialism in India. So the sensible thing to do is to have a military parity with the aggressor to be able to basically put an end to their aggression, not out of their humanity, but out of their fear, because the only language they understand is force. And this goes to show that this is the only world leader in the world that bows to no one but God and fears no one but God. And that is a very, very amicable trait to have in a world filled with rulers who are really devil worshippers and servants of the devil himself.
Muslims in many countries around the world, including in West Asia, are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Millions of people attended congregational Eid prayers in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen in the morning of the festive occasion. In Iran, the prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at the iconic Imam Khomeini Prayers Ground in Tehran. Prayers and sermons are also held in cities, towns, and villages across Iran. In the occupied Palestine, nearly 100,000 worshippers perform the prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, despite restrictive measures by the Israeli regime. This year's Eid is being celebrated under the shadow of Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Muslims in other countries would mark the Eid with mass prayers on Thursday. Palestinians continue to face an endless nightmare of death and destruction in Gaza, where U.S.-Israeli genocide is now in its seventh month. Israeli aircraft and artillery fire continue in various parts of the Gaza Strip, targeting homes and gatherings of displaced people. In the latest Israeli airstrike, at least 14 civilians were killed in Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 153 civilians have been killed and 60 others injured across the besieged strip in a matter of 24 hours. Meanwhile, civil defense workers say they've recovered the bodies of 409 Palestinians from Al-Shifa Medical Complex in the north and the city of Khan Yunis in the south. The operations were made possible after Israeli forces pulled out from the southern city and ended their siege on the hospital. Since the start of the U.S.-Israeli onslaught On Palestinians, over 33,300 people have been killed in Gaza. But the United Nations Deputy Secretary General has expressed deep concerns over the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. Amina Mohammed said in a UN press conference that the international community has lost its, quote, moral compass on Gaza. She warned that thousands of children continue to be killed and maimed in Israel's genocidal war against the Gaza Strip. The top UN official called for immediate action on the humanitarian situation in the besieged territory. Earlier, the UN chief Antonio Guterres called for a humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. That, as a report by the UN, stated that more children have been killed in the Israeli war on Gaza than in 4 years of conflicts worldwide. And Israel has faced tremendous international pressure to end its genocidal war in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the starving territory as dire shortages push its population on the brink of famine. Now the United Nations says Israel is blocking far more convoys carrying food aid within Gaza than convoys carrying other kinds of aid.
UN-coordinated food deliveries are much more likely to be impeded or denied access to areas requiring coordination within Gaza than any other humanitarian mission. So this is bureaucratic language for the fact that food convoys that should be going particularly to the north, where 70% of people face famine conditions, are more likely, actually three times more likely to be denied than any other humanitarian convoy with other kinds of material. And when you put up statistics with numbers of trucks going in, saying, look at all these hundreds of trucks going in, and you put it against, look how few trucks have actually moved around with the distribution. Well, it's kind of an own goal, isn't it? Because half of the convoys that we were trying to send to the north with food were denied by the very same Israeli authority. There are opening hours at these crossings. What often happens is that things move across from Israel into Gaza, and then they sleep overnight because it's not open anymore for the Gaza side to come in and pick up trucks.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says a proposal made in the latest round of the Gaza ceasefire talks does not meet the Palestinians' demands. Hamas says there was no change in the Israeli stance in the Cairo talks. Earlier we discussed the topic in our news review program. Let's listen to what our guests have to say.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the proposal reached during the latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks does not meet the movement's and the Palestinians' demands. Hamas says Israel's position in the negotiations held in Egypt remains stubborn. The movement, however, said that it is still studying the proposal and will inform mediators of its response once it is completely reviewed. Hamas did not set any time frame for its response. The movement says that it wants a comprehensive ceasefire that would see the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and the return of Gazans to their homes. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is a main topic as well. The Cairo talks were attended by delegations from Israel, Hamas, Qatar, and the United States. Muslim Gumsaya is a Palestinian scientist and author who joins us from Bethlehem. We also have Booker Ngessa, member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, who joins us from Nairobi. Welcome to you both. Muslim Gumsaya, let me first start with you. Let's have your take on Israel's behavior here when it comes to these talks. First of all, they were prompted by the assassination of those charity workers from the World Kitchen Charity. Brought them out. Israel sent a delegation. And then you have supposedly these talks somewhat in motion, and then you have Israel come out now and say, we're going to attack Rafah, setting a time and date. It doesn't sound like Israel is very serious when it comes to these talks.
They intend to continue the genocide. That's their whole intention. And the Israeli government doesn't really care about its own citizens that are held by Hamas, including high-ranking Israeli military officers. This has been clear all along. It's a question of increasing pressure on Israel now after 6 months have passed What are they going to do? Are they going to let the rest of these people die as they continue bombing the areas of Gaza into basically flattening all of Gaza? Or are they going to really make some sort of a deal? My own estimation is that there will be some sort of a deal. It will not be ideal for us as Palestinians, because it will try to save Israel and get Israel from, basically get it out of the mayhem of the trap that they put themselves into Gaza. And that's, to try and get something by political negotiations they didn't get by force.
Booker, why do you think so many are saying that if Israel was to agree to a ceasefire agreement, that would mark a huge defeat for Israel, in particular for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
First, it's important to realize that the Israel state under the leadership of Netanyahu is not going for negotiation on a point of strength. In fact, they have been forced by their failures in the battlefield to now resort to negotiation on a diplomatic way to cover their failures in the battlefield. It's important that the Zionist leadership has continuously said that the Hamas is a terrorist outfit. Why would they be on the table with the people they consider to be terrorists? It's indeed because of Netanyahu's failure in leadership within the occupied territory, where there is pressure, for the hostages to be released.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank Mazen Hopsaya, Palestinian scientist and author, and also Booker Ngessa, member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
Lebanon says it will continue selling arms to Israel amid mounting calls for the UK to cancel arms export licenses to the regime. British Foreign Minister made the announcement while holding a joint news conference with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Washington. David Cameron said he had reviewed the most recent legal advice on the situation in Gaza, but he stressed the UK's position on export licenses to Israel will remain unchanged. Last week, over 600 British legal experts signed a letter calling on their government to halt arms sales to Israel. They argued that the trade could make Britain complicit in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. London has approved over $614 million of weapons sales to Israel since 2015. A number of Google employees have quitted their jobs over the company's cloud contract with Israel. The resignations reportedly come in protests against Project Nimbus, which is a $1.2 billion contract with Israel, jointly held with Amazon to provide AI and cloud computing services to Israel. A protest group called No Tech for Apartheid says more than 1,000 Amazon and Google employees back their efforts for stopping the contract with Israel. Last week, a member of the group interrupted a conference promoting the Israeli tech industry and condemned Google's support for Israel.
I'm a Google Cloud software engineer, and I refuse to build technology that powers genocide, apartheid, or surveillance. Project Nimbus puts Palestinian community members in danger. I refuse to build technology that's going to be used for cloud apartheid. No cloud for apartheid. No tech for apartheid. Free Palestine.
Hatfield has been fired after his protest. During the conference, Project Nimbus reportedly involves Google establishing a secure instance of Google Cloud in the occupied territories. It would allow the regime to perform large-scale data analysis, AI training, database hosting, and other forms of powerful computing. Recent reports in the Israeli media indicate that airstrikes are being carried out with the support of AI targeting systems. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody. We'll be right back.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Palestine Chronicle spoke with two journalists and a resident from Gaza who witnessed the devastation caused by the Zionist regime bombing on the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, 6 months of the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza have made millions of people displaced. According to United Nations figures, as of January, a staggering 85% of the total population of Gaza, 1.9 million civilians, had been forcibly displaced by the Zionist regime's military operations. The situation in the makeshift refugee camps across the Gaza Strip is catastrophic, with medical sources raising the alarm about the spread of diseases, particularly among children. Unfortunately, even living in a tent amid extreme hardship does not guarantee safety, as no place has been safe in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of the Zionist regime's assault on October 7th. On March 31st, Israeli regime bombs targeted a group of tents set up for journalists inside the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the central city of Deir al-Balah. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with two journalists and a resident from Gaza who witnessed the devastation caused by the Zionist regime bombing. Palestinian journalist Ayman Shama told the Palestine Chronicle it was a Sunday morning, half an hour before the noon prayer, when we were surprised by the Israeli shelling. They bombed the gate of the reception and emergency department inside the hospital. At least two people were killed and many others wounded. Ambulances and dozens of tents were damaged, along with some parts of the hospital. He continued, they targeted the vicinity of the tents of journalists, where live broadcasts are carried out to cover the arrival of martyrs and injuries to the hospital. From there, journalists also communicate live with their channels in a desperate attempt to convey the suffering of the people of Gaza, expose the crimes of the occupation, and spread the Palestinian voice to the world. In the attack, dozens of tents were burned or damaged, and many displaced people were scattered. He said, hospitals are not safe. No place is safe to everyone in Gaza. Palestinian journalist Mohammad Al-Khatib told the Palestine Chronicle, during these 6 months of war, the occupation bombed houses very close to the hospital, and Apache helicopters fired at the displaced people inside the complex, but we did not expect the Israeli occupation forces to directly bomb the hospital compound and kill displaced people within the hospital walls, he said. Al-Khatib explained, this is a new crime committed by the occupation, which should be included in the trial for genocide before the International Court of Justice. Hassan Nofal is a young resident from Gaza. Since his sister was seriously injured 4 months ago, he and his family embarked on a desperate journey to look for safety. Nofal told Palestine Chronicle, "My sister was seriously injured during the shelling of her husband's house for over 4 months ago. We fled with my family, my injured sister, and my younger brother, who suffers from a severe disability, to the European hospital in the eastern part of the southern city of Khan Yunis city. After the Zionist regime invasion of Khan Yunis, however, the family moved again." He explained, "We brought my sister with us and set up a tent inside the Al-Aqsa hospital, where my injured sister received treatment inside the tent." Nofal said, "On March 31st, my mother and my injured sister traveled to receive treatment. I stayed in a tent with my younger sister and my disabled brother. The bombing targeted a tent very close to ours, but we were spared injury." He added, while still in a very emotional state, "The bombing caused a state of fear and panic among all the displaced people." Nofal lamented, "All the displaced people inside the hospital are either injured or patients who need to be close to the hospital to receive treatment. What the occupation is doing in Gaza is beyond human imagination."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli fighter jets have bombed homes in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood. 153 Palestinians were killed in just one day. At least 33,360 Palestinians have been killed and around 76,000 wounded in the 6 month of ethnic cleansing in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the ICJ, International Court of Justice, has wrapped up its hearing of a Nicaraguan lawsuit against Germany, accusing it of fueling the Gaza war by selling arms to Israel. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of the program. Asad Abu Shaq, Palestinian academic and activist, is joining me from Dublin. And Eve Engler, author and political analyst, is joining us from Montreal. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Beginning with Assad, as you know, a large number of IDF troopers have pulled out of parts of Gaza, and you know, at the same time, truce talks have been in full swing in Cairo, of course, without a breakthrough. So do you expect the negotiations to come to culmination and achieve ceasefire, given all the sticking points still remaining there?
Thank you very much indeed for this question. Actually, I do not expect any results from these negotiations, because the Americans are totally supporting the point of view of the Israeli. For example, they didn't call for immediate and lasting ceasefire. They didn't call for the withdrawal of Israeli troops or for the punishment of the Israeli troops for their genocidal war against the Palestinians. All they care for is the Israelis who were held, I mean the Israeli war prisoners of war who are held by the Palestinian resistance movement, and that it's after they are released, of course, Israel will be more savage, more brutal, and ethnic cleansing program and war will continue. The Americans cannot and may not and will not be fair mediators. The Americans represent the point of view of the Israelis. That is to say, the Egyptians and the Qataris on one side are negotiating with the Americans, who are Zionists themselves and representing the point of view of Netanyahu. And up to this moment, they did not negotiate from a neutral point of view, and they did not like to put any kind of pressure on Israel to withdraw its troops. On the contrary, they are putting pressure on Egypt and Qatar in order to put pressure on Hamas to succumb to the Israeli points and Israeli demands put on the table by the so-called American mediators.
Okay. Now, allow me to ask Eve this question. Eve, Hamas has rejected this latest ceasefire proposal presented by mediators in Egypt. It says it does not meet the Palestinians' demands. It also slams the Israeli Prime Minister's threat that the invasion of Rafah already has a starting date, you know, in the midst of all these negotiations. So does Tel Aviv truly want a ceasefire?
No, I don't think Tel Aviv truly wants a ceasefire. I think that they would, they're under a lot of pressure to not go in full scale into Rafah. I think there is U.S. pressure that would prefer to not have, you know, thousands and thousands more, or maybe even tens of thousands more Palestinians killed. It's becoming a political problem for the Biden administration within the U.S. It's becoming increasingly a political problem regionally, with, you know, Turkey bringing in sanctions, even if those are, you know, ultimately very limited. Also, I think that, you know, you see where the French and the Jordanians and Egyptian leaders publishing op-ed in U.S. media calling for a ceasefire. So I think the pressure is mounting, but Netanyahu, for his own personal reasons, he wants to continue the war as long as possible. He's also, of course, aligned with these totally extremist Jewish supremacists, who themselves have made clear they're going to, they won't, they'll, you know, try to have the government fall if they don't go into Rafah. But they don't want a ceasefire. I mean, I think they're being pressured into it. Obviously, when you announce a plan, though they haven't given an actual date for invasion of Rafah, while simultaneously negotiating over a ceasefire, it's a little bit of a contradictory position. But I think it speaks to the fact that no, Netanyahu and Israeli government doesn't actually want a ceasefire. They want to continue killing and making Gaza as unlivable as possible.
Okay. Now, Asad, let me quote something. Listen to this quotation. There is no force in the world that will stop us. There are many forces that are trying to do so, but it will not help, since this enemy, after what it did, will never do it again. This is Netanyahu's words, right? Is he right? No force is able to stop the Tel Aviv regime's atrocities against Palestinians?
You see, the Israel has been created by the West and has been supported by the West, and the volunteers and technology and espionage and weapons and 200,000 bombs from America, in addition to trainers and volunteers and money. And only last week, I think the Americans decided to give $18 billion worth dollars of weapons to Israel. I think if the Americans are serious and honest, not hypocritical, they can just order Netanyahu to withdraw. They did it before in 1956. Eisenhower. They can order him just to withdraw all. But I don't think that the Americans are serious. The Americans, of course, are doing that for local consumption, for their, you know, the election, for presidential election, for and order to fool the Arab and the Muslim world and all the world, the world. But I think the game is exposed. And I think, no, Israel, if the Americans are serious, if the Europeans are serious, I think they can put an end just by a telephone call from Biden. But the Americans are not serious. They are fooling everybody. And the Israelis, you see, cannot survive. The Israelis cannot survive, neither as a nation, nor as an army, nor as a leadership, without the, this support coming from the West and from America. Mm-hmm. So, this is a game. The Americans are liars, they are being hypocritical. And look, for example, Biden himself said, if there were no Israel, we could have invented it. And he said, I am Zionist, and I will be Zionist, and I support the state of Israel.
Right.
And on the 2nd of October, he went with all the leaders of the West. No. I think Israel is surrogate, European, Western state. Israel serves their own interests. It is planted as a dagger in the heart of the Arab and Muslim world to serve the interests of the West.
Okay. Now, Netanyahu has stressed that the IOF will proceed with its goal of eliminating all of Hamas's brigades, in his words, including those in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. And you know, Rafah is where 1.5 million displaced Palestinians are taking shelter, and many are warning that a Rafah attack would end up in a catastrophe for the civilian population there. So can anything justify the planned offensive on Rafah?
No, but I think that you can't justify almost everything that Israel's done in Gaza over the past 6 months. If they do go in, it would be a crime on top of a crime on top of a crime on top of a crime. I think that international opinion has turned so much against Israel that it will be difficult for Netanyahu to pull that off. But they are pretty drunk on their own power, and they have been pushing the bounds of anything that any reasonable person would consider is possible. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's I think there's a pretty good chance they're going to try. It will lead to incredible horror, but that sort of hasn't stopped them in the past. And unless the countries that have been enabling the Israeli Holocaust in Gaza, unless they don't just rhetorically say, "Oh, don't do this," but bring in some concrete measures, and there are a whole host of measures they can bring in. I mean, simply ending arms permits. I mean, it's very simple things. It's nothing complicated.
Right.
That's a huge message, and it will reverberate all through Israeli political, military life.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, speaking of arms, the ICJ has concluded its second and final day of hearings into Nicaragua's complaint against Germany that's accused of facilitating the genocide in Gaza by supplying the Israeli regime with arms. Now, how effective, in your opinion, could an ICJ ruling be? They have no mechanism to enforce their rulings. Would it be able to force Germany to stop selling arms to Israel?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, the decision taken by ICG are just are not binding. They are just recommendations, and they are not binding because, you know, even previously they took, the ICG took a decision regarding the separation, the apartheid goal, and it's fine, but these are just mere, recommendations or non-binding resolutions. But this is, anyway, it is a step to expose, it's a very good step to expose the hypocrisy and the complicity and the involvement of the West, the so-called white supremacists in the West, who totally support Israel to continue its genocide, which has never, ever been heard in history. But this is a good step, and we call upon the ICG also to bring all those states, from America to Britain to Germany to everybody who sell weapons to Israel, to kill the Palestinians and to kill, annihilate Palestinian children, men, women, to destroy hospitals, schools, churches, mosques, infrastructure. Everything has been destroyed by Western. Who destroys Gaza? It is F-15, F-35, German rockets, British rockets, French rockets, training, technology, espionage, personnel. So right. The whole West is a criminal. The whole America is a criminal. Germany is a criminal. Britain is a criminal. France is a criminal. The European Union is a criminal. Imagine all the whole world is against the civilians of Gaza. This is ridiculous. Has happened in history. So I think we need not only the ICG but the ICC to bring those leaders, being war criminals, to be tried as war criminals, and then to apply also Chapter 7 of the United Nations against the rogue state of Israel.
Eve, on the second day of the hearing, that was today, Germany argued in the defense that nearly all its military exports to Israel since October 7 have been defensive in nature. They also argued that the ICJ lacks jurisdiction on the case. Now, does ICJ lack jurisdiction in the case? If so, which tribunal has jurisdiction?
I don't think it lacks jurisdiction. I think ICJ, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that ICJ does have a jurisdiction. I think this case is testing some new legal area, but is there are some precedents of officials being governments being held accountable for arming genocide. I just want to say, with regards to the ICJ, doesn't have the mechanism to necessarily enforce a decision. But I think if it does rule, and this is probably not too likely, but if it does do a interim or emergency ruling that says that Germany needs to stop arming Israel, I think that's going to put a whole lot of pressure on the German government to do that. And I would go one step beyond that. My government, the Canadian government, which is the fourth or fifth biggest armor of Israel, it will put a whole lot of pressure even on the Canadian government if there's a ruling against Germany calling on Germany to stop arming Israel. So I think that even if the enforcement mechanism is, you know, they're not going to actually, you know, in the case of the South Africa's case, they obviously they have enforced Israel to stop doing its genocidal policies in Gaza. But I think countries like Germany and Canada are, in fact, much more vulnerable, politically speaking, to an ICJ ruling than Israel is. So I think it would be quite a significant, it could have quite a significant impact, though I don't think it's too likely that the court's going to, you know, make that interim ruling, but I think it would be quite a good step if it did.
Now, as I said, speaking of Western support for Israel in the war on Gaza, Australia's Defense Department has said it won't release details of arms transfers to Israel because it would damage Australia's reputation. Now, the West, you know, the UK, the Germany, the US in particular, they have been selling arms to Israel and has been using them in the massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The question is, why should all these Western states aid and abet the Israeli regime in its genocidal war on Palestinians?
You know, don't forget that who created Israel? It is the West. Who supports Israel? It is the West.
Right.
Because Israel serves their own interest to keep the Arab world divided and to keep the Muslim world divided, and then to plunder the resources, natural resources, oil, gas, whatever, and to keep the Arab world and the Muslim world divided, and to control that, to keep their hegemony, and to control that part of the world. And this is, of course, at the expense of the Palestinian people. And this is not the first time they do that. You know that in all the wars, they helped Israel against in 1967, 1956, 1973, 1982, in all the wars which Israel launched against the Palestinians, the Arabs, the Muslims, whatever, Israel used weapons supplied by the West. And then Israel, if you want to, from legal point of view, Israel is an occupying power. And Israel doesn't have any right to self-defense. And the Palestinians have every right, according to UN resolutions, according to international law, Palestinians have every right to resist the occupying power. Israel is an occupying power. And then when the Germans say we are supplying defensive weapons, this is rather ridiculous. Because Israel is an occupying power. How come that you supply an occupying power launching genocide war against the Palestinian people, and then now you say this is these are defensive weapons? You are violating international law, you are violating humanitarian law, you are also violating your democracy, or the so-called democracy or human rights, which you have always been regurgitating and mouthing in the West. So I think Israel serves the interest of the world. Israel is their wild dog, wild wolf, which they unleash whenever they like against any Arab or Muslim country that opposes them.
I see. Now, if Palestinians returning to their homes in Khan Yunus after the Israeli army's withdrawal, they're expressing shock, you know, at the scale of destruction there. You know, how things are. Infrastructure is in ruins, no hospital left, you know, no schools, public schools. Most of them have been totally or partially destroyed. So who's going to have to foot the bill for all this massive and unprecedented destruction?
Well, in a just world, of course, it would be Israel and Israel's sponsors. In the world that we live in, I don't know. Who, there's going to probably be some effort to get some Middle Eastern, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar to fund reconstruction. But at this point, I mean, I think that it's still a long way off before the, you know, reconstruction kind of takes place. But I know, I think in anything approaching a just world, Israel, of course, would be the main government responsible for compensating Palestinians, and then countries like the U.S. and Canada that have been involved in enabling the destruction should also be contributing, because the destruction is just every different story from every different angle. You hear about, you know, from the destruction of agricultural lands to the destruction of all the hospitals to the destruction of all the universities, destruction of all the buildings and the homes. It's just unbelievable the degree of mayhem that Israel has waged in Gaza in such a short period of time. There's these images of you know, Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine, 2 years after Russia's war, which everyone in the West says is so brutal, and it's all, you know, everything's basically in order. And then next to it is, you know, 2 weeks into Israel's bombing campaign in Gaza, and, you know, most of Gaza City is already destroyed.
Exactly.
So it's stunning.
Yeah. Asad, my last question. Some countries have been mulling according recognition to Palestinian statehood. You know, it's the war. Lots of people in it have been killed. Lots of also material human losses in this genocidal war. But there are also some good aspects. Like countries like even the UK, Ireland, Malta, Slovenia, Spain, Australia, they're mulling, they're floating this idea of recognizing a Palestinian state. So it looks like that this war has also somehow benefited the Palestinians, you know, in terms of their bid for statehood. And also, just yesterday, they applied for full UN membership. Don't you agree?
You see, we have 1,000 resolutions in the United Nations calling for our, for example, resolution 19-2326. Right. It calls for our right to self-determination, our right to return and compensation, our right to statehood and sovereignty, our right to resistance. Now, if the West is honest, and they are not honest, and they are hypocritical, if they are honest, all they need to do is to implement UN resolutions taken by the international community.
Right.
Some of them agreed to these resolutions. So, and if they cannot do that, now it is high time for them to recognize Palestine as a full-fledged member state of the United Nations and to recognize our right of self-determination, which is very, very important,
okay,
and our right of compensation and return to our property, home, from which we were uprooted.
Okay. I'm sorry for jumping in. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have had. Thank you, my guests, Asad Abu Sharq, Palestinian academic and activist in Dublin, and Yves Engler, author and political activist in Montreal, Canada. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdha' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety. This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge, and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the Imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, His select, His party, the case of His knowledge, His argument, His path, His light, His proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam, the 10th divinely appointed Imam alayhi salam. So when talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, you know, we find that there's a conversation that His Eminence has with one of his companions. Now, this conversation, it was a long conversation, and there was a lot of different things that were spoken of between Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam and this companion of his. But in one specific place, we find in this conversation that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam talks about intention. And what's really interesting is that it's a beautiful conversation and profound and quite deep, if you will, that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about how intention, or in Arabic is known as niyyah, this intention is what leads a human being towards their deeds. So before you commit an action, good or bad, there is this intention, this niyyah, that initial catalyst or that spark, right, that doesn't make you, but it is the motivator, it is the catalyst that you know, eventually leads to you doing an action. So, you know, whether you want to call it thinking about it or deciding about it or, you know, intention, your niyyah is really intention, I guess, is the best way to put it. So this intention of yours is really important, right, before you commit the action. So the intention, of course, and this is why we have been taught that one should always say qurbatan ila Allah, or for the nearness of Allah, right? Taqarrub ila Allah, taqarrub meaning nearness to and Allah meaning of course Allah, qurbatan ila Allah, qurba meaning nearness, right? And Allah, you know, of course, to Allah. Now, just even though it's kind of perhaps inconsequential, but I think it's significant now that it's come up, is please be careful. There are two ways to say this and one way is not correct. You have qurbatan illa Allah, right? The tashdeed is in a different place. Qurbatan illa Allah. This means nearness to other than Allah. So be very careful that you're not doing that. Correct pronunciation is qurbatan illa Allah, right? You understand the difference. Illa Allah and illa Allah. So the correct pronunciation is qurbatan illa Allah. So this niyyah is incredibly important, and Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam says that it is the basis of this intention that people commit their deeds. And this intention, he says, is within one's heart, and whoever has this pure and sincere niyyah in their heart, their actions are likewise going to be sincere. And it is that sincere niyyah along with that sincere action that is accepted by the Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income and better health insurance payouts.